Mate, congrats on this album. It is something that I was not expecting to hear from Tom Morello because it is so diverse from track to track. I think my first question needs to be, how did this all come about? Like, how did you find these different people to collaborate with?
You know, this was a record that was born of lockdown. It's a plague album. From the time I was 17 till March of 2020, I had been writing, recording, and performing at a manic pace, and it all came to a screeching halt. You know, for the first time in my adult life, I was not a musician, or I was not a musician who was going to be able to connect in any way. And inspiration came from a very unlikely source. I read an interview with Kanye West where he said that he had recorded the vocals for a couple of his big hit albums onto the voice memo of his iPhone. So I started recording guitar riffs into my phone. They sounded fantastic. So I started sending these riffs off to different engineers and producers and artists around the world. And here I was, cloistered, lonely and alone in the bunker of my studio, creating this kind of rock and roll pen pal community around the world. And Bruce Springsteen was in New Jersey. Bring Me the Horizon was in Brazil in the UK. Chris Stapleton was in Nashville. Mike Posner was in Nepal, summiting Everest while we were doing that song. Damian Marley was in Jamaica. Refused were in Sweden. And Salma Abdulhadi was in Palestine. So what was this kind of absolutely abject aloneness became this global connection with these artists that forged the Atlas Underground Fire.
It's amazing that you talk about where these people were, because when you talk to someone, you don't go, hey, how you doing? You know exactly how they're doing because we're all going through exactly the same thing.
That's right.
And so that's what's cool about this album in that sense. It's like, well, I know exactly what you're doing. You're stuck at home in your studio.
That's right.
I'm stuck at home in mine. And that's how the world's getting on at the moment.
That's right. And it's a way, you know, it was a way to, one, sort of reflect the time. And there are some songs that do that, like the Chris Stapleton song, The War Inside, and the Bring Me the Horizon jam, Let's Get the Party Started, and maybe the Fantagram song, Driving to Texas. They sort of reflect the anxiety and the pressure, and whether you slip into depression or whether you party your ass off till you die because you're confronted with this mountain of anxiety. But it's also a way of sort of asserting that you can transcend it with music. And yes, we are all alone. We are each alone, but together we've created something, and then that something can go into the world and it can connect with people who may also be alone, you know, whether they're in lockdown or emerging from it or whatever. But that was like sort of the feeling that the stars do still shine above the cloud cover.
It's interesting that you say you were recording things to the voice memo part of your phone. Did you actually use any of those direct?
95% of the guitars on the album were recorded into my phone.
That's why it makes sense now.
The only song was the grandson song. We recorded that music beforehand.
Because I did notice the theme that there was this dirty electronic fizzed out sound of your guitar. And I jotted it down in my notes, like Save Our Souls with Dennis from Refuse has got that sound.
Yeah.
And that's when I went, is this a new effect that you use? But it's called the iPhone effect.
In a way. Yeah.
I mean, that is more Tom Morello than you can get.
They're right. I just had, like, literally my phone sitting on a folding chair in front of my amp. There's no YouTube tutorial for that.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know whether it's supposed to be 3 inches away or 19 inches away. Well, it's on the chair, you know? And then I would just, you know, put on headphones to listen to a beats per minute or not. And then just on that particular day, come up with 3 or 4 riffs. And it was almost like a roulette. And I would literally sit there and go, who might I like to do a song with?
Yeah.
Whatever riffs on that particular day, and whoever I came across on Spotify or in my Rolodex, that's who the song was with.
And that's how it worked. You just chose people kind of at random.
Not entirely random, but it was like, sometimes it was old friends, you know, Springsteen and Eddie Vedder I've known for a while. Damian Marley and I have played a show together, Fantagram, and I've worked together. But sometimes it was literally calling up a friend whose musical tastes are cooler than mine and go, what's the last great song that you heard by someone I don't know? And they'd said, Femme. And I was like, okay. So I checked out Femme, like, she's fantastic. So I just cold called her and said, hi, this is Tom Morello. I don't know if you even know who I am, but you want to do a song? I've been home for the last 9 months doing this every day. Do you want to do a song? And she was like, right on. So we recorded Night Witch, you know.
That's a phone call I would love to have been a fly on the wall
for.
Hey, this is Tom Morello. I don't know if you know who I am. Come on, man. Selling yourself short.
She's young. I didn't want to assume, you know.
Driving to Texas with Fantagram, that one really grabbed my attention. So I'd love to know more about that.
I had worked with Josh, who's one half of Fantagram, on my previous Atlas Underground record. He, Marcus Mumford, and I did a song together. And then he and Sarah, the other half of Fantagram, they reached out like during this, you know, desolate year and just said, hey, we'd love to do a song with you. I'm like, I'm open for business. You know, like my schedule's open today. They sent me a track of like sort of a partially formed song. And that I love the challenge of that, because it wasn't a tune that began with some big Tom Morello riffs. It was like, okay, here's this kind of spooky electro vibe. How am I going to respond to that? I just thought, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to let go. And I just sent maybe 40 different ideas back to Josh.
Wow.
Here's just a spooky noise. Here's a big guitar riff. Here's something that sounds like a solo. Here's something that's not even in the same key. Here's some feedback washes. And like, here are now the colors for a sonic palette for you to apply your production genius to, you know, and just kind of standing back and then going, let's see what happens.
And then you go from that to such a well-known song that you did with Bruce and Eddie on Highway to Hell, but you changed the riff just a little bit.
Well, that song has its origins in your homeland there.
Yeah.
I was playing guitar in the E Street Band in 2014 when we were playing in Perth, Australia, the home of Bon Scott. And I went to go pay my respects to his grave late one night. It was about 11:30 at night. And I could not find the grave. I was disappointed to find that there is not an eternal flame burning on Bon Scott. Someone needs to look into that.
Yeah.
So out of the mist comes this motorbike in the graveyard around midnight. And it's this heavyset guy with like a German army helmet and a t-shirt, which reads, I don't give a shit, but if I did, you're the one I'd give it to. And I was like, that guy is going to know where Bon Scott's grave is. Right. And of course he does. Pay my respects. I see Bruce in the hotel bar later. I'm like, Bruce, do you think that there's any way that the spiritual world of the E Street Band and the spiritual world of AC/DC overlap? And he was like, maybe. So we began rehearsing Highway to Hell at soundcheck and found ourselves in Melbourne in the football stadium. And Eddie Vedder happened to be in town. He was there on a solo acoustic tour. And light bulb went off. And I knocked on Bruce's dressing room door before the show. I said, Bruce, we are in Australia, where AC/DC is king, where the song Highway to Hell is the unofficial national anthem of rock and roll liberation on this continent. What if we open the set with Highway to Hell with Eddie Vedder? And he was like, that's a pretty good idea. We did. And it was an apex moment in the history of live rock and roll music. And as I was sitting here, that was the last song that I recorded for the Atlas Underground Fire. As I was sitting here with all these, you know, great young artists, Bring Me the Horizon, Fanagram, Chris Stapleton, Fem, all them, I thought, I need to make a song with my rock brothers. I want to remember what it felt like, the electricity on that stage at that moment, one of the greatest rock and roll songs of all time, sung by two of the greatest rock and roll singers of all time, with this moment of, like, as Hemingway said, living all the way up. Like, there's nothing more than crazier than 80,000 people all losing their shit at one time while we're sitting here quietly alone, waiting for the plague to pass. And I wanted to capture that lightning on that track.
I was at that gig, went well over time, which was itself in a treat because that's just the way Bruce rolls.
Yeah.
But I remember that feeling when that show started, and even now talking about it sort of gives me, goosebumps because it was such a special night.
Yeah.
And you never wanted it to end.
Yes. That night, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember very, very clearly because later on in the hotel bar, Bruce was like, so what's it like playing a E Street Band show versus playing a Rage Against the Machine show? And I'd say, Bruce, I got to tell you, I am actually in some ways more exhausted after an E Street Band show than I am ever. And he's like, really? He's like, I'm like, yeah, because like, Bruce, E Street Band shows are, you know, hours and hours long. Rage shows are super intense, but Rage shows are cardio intense. E Street Band shows are orthopedically intense.
And you got a guy way older than you who's outperforming everyone.
So, but in that show, that Melbourne show, we're 3 hours into the show. We've played the hits. People have cried from emotion. They've jumped up and down. There's been Bruce's stage dive and like everything could possibly happen that's awesome in a show has happened. And Bruce says into the microphone without the hint of irony, are you ready to get this party started? And then we play another hour.
We're going to touch on Let's Get the Party Started with Bring Me the Horizon. What a massive track that one is. And as you said, the band's still split between Brazil and the UK, and then you're in LA. Was that one that you just kind of shot off ideas to?
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the fact that they've been like standard bearers for hard rock and metal, you know, in an era where there aren't as many standard bearers as there perhaps once were. But, you know, I firmly believe that the guitar has a future and not just a past. And so I had some big riffs and just thought, let's just see, and sent it off to Ollie and George. And, you know, that song I would say probably of all the songs on the record maybe took sort of the most crafting. You know, probably it would have happened in an afternoon if we were all in a room, but since we're on, you know, three different continents, it took a while to sort of get that, to get it together. And it's one of my favorite songs that I've ever been a part of. It really reminds, and the video too, one of the things I got very adept at during this pandemic was directing videos for like less than $1,000. You know, a little bit of ripping from YouTube, a little bit of, you know, finding footage here, there, and the other. But we made a video for that song that celebrates like the once and future mosh pit. The song is about like confronting this mountain of anxiety by partying yourself to death. But it feels like just a huge, awesome, kick-ass, rocking metal jam, which is, you know, in some ways, maybe what the world needs.
Yeah. See, that one, and of course, Highway to Hell, it's funny that you mentioned party, because that's how they both feel. They both feel like a real celebration song.
And
it really just gets you fired up.
It's incredible that those songs were recorded like in total isolation.
Yeah.
You know, in the feeling in my mind, like I want to transcend this loneliness in a way that like, I can't feel it in this room, but maybe I can feel it in my fingers. And then somehow my phone catches some part of that that then translates to Brazil and translates to the UK. And at the end of the day, it's, you know, a 3.5 minute song that's going to kick your ass.
Yeah, absolutely. Another song, we mentioned it earlier as well, Save Our Souls with Dennis from Refused. And that's when it really hit me, that dirty electronic fuzzy sound that you've explained is just you recording into your phone. I've written in my notes here, lots of guitar tricks and noises, and I'm going,
So it's
not really, it's just iPhone. And so,
yeah. And that was produced by Bloody Beetroots, who, you know, the great like Italian punk rock EDM producer. And, you know, I love Dennis, I love Refused, and they're one of my favorite, like, kind of punk hard bands. And he's, I got to tell you, like, the only problem I had with that song was narrowing it down. I would send him a riff, and he'd send me a song back later that day. We got a bunch of those songs. Like, we could have done a whole EP of Refused collaborations, all of which are great jams. But to me, that was the one that it really hit the hardest. And I like that dirty guitar sound on that one too.
Someone recorded your first ever gig with Rage Against the Machine at Cal State in October 1991. And then I look and I go, a year and 10 days later, you release the self-titled album that changed music. And I have this discussion with so many people. Rage Against the Machine changed metal, in my opinion, because no one had done what you'd done. Can you believe it's like this long on now?
The short answer is no. I very clearly remember that Cal State gig. It's funny, you see in the video is, you know, it's a lunchtime concert.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, this is my mom. I just got to tell her I'm going to come get her in a minute. Hello? No, when I'm free, I'm going to come get you. I'm on an interview with Australia right now, but I'll be right there. Goodbye. My studio is in my mom's basement. That was my mom calling from upstairs right now. I still play in my mom's basement.
I love this. Right?
And so we're just on a stage and it's the first show. No one's waiting to see us. So you can see at the beginning, people are just like sort of walking back and forth in front of the band. And then the indication of things to come is there's these two metal dudes. And you can see that they don't trust what they're seeing. Like, there's elements to it that are maybe speaking to them, but there are elements that they are uncomfortable with. And then the end of the song, Bullet in the Head, comes. And, you know, the dun 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 dun. And when the beat drops on that, one of them turns to the other one. One turns this way, and they turn this way, and then they bang their heads. And drop the microphone. There you go. And good night. Thank you very much. That's it.
You won them over in one song. You won over two blokes who had never heard what you'd done before.
You could tell that they were holding on to, let's just say, let's be generous, since they were holding on to some traditional notions
of what
rock music should look like and maybe sound like. And then they were like, oh, they surrendered. They just surrendered.
They were overwhelmed. And I think that's the effect that Rage had way back in 1992. You know, I just turned 18. It was actually, the album was released the day before I turned 18. And so you can imagine, as a 17-year-old, finding new music and new metal from around the world and just getting into new sounds, and then Rage comes, forget about it, you know. We just had Nevermind the year before, the Black Album. You know, we'd had all these iconic Blood Sugar Sex Magik. And in 92, forget all that. This is different. This is something you've never heard. This is something that has changed the world. And continues to this day. I mean, you guys are iconic. On a sadder note, next year, of course, is 5 years since we've lost Chris Cornell, someone who you worked with extensively in Audioslave, another band that I was very close to after the demise of Rage Against the Machine. Audioslave was just this magnificent coming together of forces. And there's nothing I can really ask you about, Chris, that you probably have never been asked before. Just, I don't think I know of a better rock voice in my generation.
I can't believe it's 5 years. It's just nuts. And, you know, and I miss him every day, and I think about him every day, and it's just, it's a horrible wound that never heals, honestly. So after Rage Against the Machine broke up in 2000, Tim and Brad and I knew we wanted to play together, and we knew we wanted Rick Rubin to make our next record. So we spent a lot of time over at Rick's house listening to music. We kept returning to Bad Motorfinger, and particularly the song Slaves and Bulldozers, and just like, and cranked up in Rick's like listening room, and just kind of like, Chris Cornell, like, what an incredible voice and what an incredible like lyricist too. We were really sort of, and like, but the thing was, like, from the lyrics are kind of spooky to me. You're like, I don't know what this person is who writes in that voice. So, you know, we called him up. He was living in Ojai about an hour and a half away, and I was open to a meeting. So Rick and I go up there. At the time, I was so punk rock. I was driving my like 1985 Chevy Astro van, like this old beat up van. And so Rick gets it. Now, Rick Rubin doesn't go anywhere unless it's in a Rolls Royce. It's like in another Rolls Royce. And right. And so he's in my dirty beaten up van. So he's very serious about this. Right. So we drive up there. It's like kind of dusk, and Chris lives like the last loneliest house on the last loneliest hill. And it's in the darkening skies and with these pine trees around, and we pull up, and the sun is setting, and this kind of like older sort of Spanish mansion, and there's a couple motorcycles out front. We pull in, there's this long winding kind of, Transylvanian staircase that goes up to these doors, and we pull in, and we're like looking at the doors, and I swear to you, like Adam's Family style, like the doors like open, and like there he is. And Chris, 6'2", lanky of frame, kind of slowly comes loping down the steps. And Rick turns to me and goes, "Let's get the fuck out of here." we're like our souls are in peril, man. He's dark of countenance, and he comes, and we're just like, and I was like, really? And he's like, I don't know, man. And anyway, we didn't leave. Fortunately, we didn't chicken out, and we did have a band for, about 6 years, and it was awesome.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that story. That's cool. We've got to wrap it up now. Tom, thank you so much, man. An absolute pleasure as always.
Thank you. It was lovely chatting with you.